Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Bennett. Each episode, we talk about the research and practical aspects of the trauma informed movement. This podcast is not designed to replace mental health services. If you feel uncomfortable or triggered by our discussion, please consider seeking your own trauma treatment. In no way is seeking treatment an admission of weakness. It is a chance to build resiliency and experience post-traumatic trauma. You can find show notes, resources, and more at traumainformedlens.org. Welcome, friends, to the Trauma Informed Lens Podcast. I'm here today with a great guest, Dr. Andrew Hahn. And his approach is going to talk about life-centered therapy. Just looking at your website, I think we got a lot in common. Seems like we both like to pull from a lot of different best practices, ways of thinking. And I was impressed. My book was titled Connecting Paradigms of Doing This. And I was impressed by, wow, everything you're bringing in to your approach, Dr. Hahn. So I'm really excited to talk about it. I just have a quick announcement for folks. If you've heard past podcasts, my latest book, Heart Rate Variability, Integrating Biometrics as an Outcome for Trauma-Informed Organizations, we're giving it away free at OptimalHRB.com. Hopefully by the time this is published, the audiobook will be on Audible as well. So if you love audiobooks like I do, you get the one publication of the book and then you get it on Audible and you just get a little bit more of a dopamine release. So if you like listening to me, you haven't heard the audiobooks, I'm really excited. The narrator for it was really great. So hopefully that will be out by the time this is published. So Dr. Hahn, welcome to the show. I just want to give you a chance to introduce yourself and a little bit about your work on life-centered therapy.
Sure. Well, my name is Andrew Hahn. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I got my doctorate in 1985, and I became an assistant professor in a graduate program and the training director in a clinic, and I was kind of edgy therapist. And then I had some experiences that I couldn't really account for, what are generally called psi experiences. So, and it ended with an experience of healing through touch, where I was with a friend who had fallen down and we were in a very sacred place and I was flooded with light and I asked her to give me her ankle because her ankle was swollen and discolored and she couldn't walk. She was in so much pain. So I just, when I sat down, I was flooded with what felt like light, but it was like the sun, except the sun wasn't in the right place for it. And I just told her to give me her ankle and I put it on my leg and I just channeled energy into it for about 5 seconds. And after that, she said, you know, I can read auras, don't you? And I said, Roshan, my friend was Roshan. I found out an Indian mystic. I said, this was 1991. I said, you know, Roshan, I'm a nice Jewish boy from Boston. What do I know from auras? And she said, are you aware that there's pure light coming down through the crown of your head into the center of your chest and out your hands to my ankle? And I said, I can't see it the way you're talking about it, and I know it's true. And that took about 10 seconds. And when we looked down and there was no swelling, there was no discoloration, and she got up and she couldn't walk. We had to sit down because she said I was going to have to carry her out of where we were in the holy grounds of what's called the Self-Realization Fellowship. And she got up and walked with no pain. Wow. And it's sort of like I was saying to myself, we're not in Kansas anymore. So after that, I spent 2 years, which I wasn't aware of, studying everything I could to try to understand how something like that could happen. And I did a lot of trainings in what are called mystery trainings and healing through touch and shadow work and regression therapies and psycho-spiritual therapies. And I'd already studied in graduate school sort of postmodern narrative therapies and family therapy and a whole lot of other stuff. What happened after a couple of years, in 1993, I had an acquaintance and she said, you've got to go see this woman, she's doing miracles. And she told me a little story, which was that she had gone to this workshop. This is 1993, this is now 27 years ago. And the woman running the workshop, whose name was Judith, had a participant who had such a bad case of asthma, she could barely walk up the stairs. And so she did this session using something I had never heard of called muscle testing or kinesiology, which I don't know if you've heard of or not. Most people now have. And she had the person tap all over her body while she told the story. And then when she muscle tested, it said her asthma was cleared. That's her language. So she told the woman to go outside and walk. And the woman, see if she felt different. The woman went outside and walked and then started to run. And she came back and she was like really exhilarated because she said she hadn't been able to run a step in 7 years. And I thought that was really quite a story. So I said, I have to learn what Judith knows. And so Judith and I became partners, and she had sort of put together, she was not a psychologist, she was a biologist, and she was interested in the brain function. So she had learned NLP, and she had learned craniosacral therapy, and she had learned tapping.
Yeah.
Way when Callahan was the only person doing tapping, and she put them together into a simple protocol. And I had knew, you know, soul level psychology and archetypal psychology and all the things that I studied that were sort of mysteries. And I had a doctorate in clinical psychology, so I'd studied all kinds of different things. And we put it together into a field that we've gone our separate ways because our kind of our worldviews are a little bit different. But that was how we started, and we became partners. And that's how I came to this work that I've now been doing for 27 years. And officially, I've been doing it, training people for 23 years. And seeing people from all over the world. And that sort of is my background. And what we do now is, I think we have a very elegant way of working with trauma that is a little bit different from how most people work with it. And I can explain it very simply, if that would be a good place to start.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay. So let's start with a simple basic premise. Okay, why do people suffer or why do they go to therapy? I think there's only one reason, which is there's something that couldn't be handled and integrated. So I think, and I think that's my
definition. For the audience, that word integration is so powerful to me. Can you give us your definition? Because some people might not think, you know, if they're not kind of maybe in the therapeutic realm, might not understand that word. Could you give us a little quick definition of what that means to you?
Yes, when not integrated means there's an energetic explanation and then there's a pragmatic explanation. The energetic explanation is when something, you can't handle something. It's too bad, or it's too good, or it's too much, or it's too different. Most people think of trauma as being just what is too bad. But I'd say trauma is, if something is too good and you can't integrate it, it's exactly like a trauma. It's like, you know, the man who caught a pass in high school and he's talking about it at age 55 and he can't stop talking about it. I'd say that's a trauma, actually, because he's in craving, right?
Yeah.
And traumas that are too good lead to craving. But most people, we think something is too bad. And when it's too bad, it does three things. And in order to understand that, we have to understand sort of who we are as energetic beings. We're sort of field centers and flows, and the centers are called chakras in some systems, and the flows are called meridians. And when there's a trauma, what happens is it either fractures the field, so you have the feeling of like, I'm here, but I'm not all here. It's like, or I'm someplace else, and I'm not fully whole. Or it clouds the chakras, which means suddenly you're in a relationship with something, because chakras, I think, are fundamentally about relationship. And the relationship gets blurry as opposed to clarified. And it means the meridians are about flow. And when there's a trauma, it's like the flow stops and you're like a deer in headlights. That's technically what happens. From a non-technical point of view, what happens is you stop having perspective. And so you're no longer here. You're no longer fully present. You're stuck someplace and you are living that out over and over and over again. And that's essentially me, in that sense, you are dismembered. And so what we want to do literally is to remember, which means not remembering has nothing to do with time. It means to bring back together that which has been broken apart or that which has been clouded over, that's what's been frozen. So that's what I mean by being integrated. And I would say when you're fully integrated, you can say yes to everything. And when you can fully say yes to everything, you're free. And what I'm inviting people in, although we get amazing stories of trauma relief, which I can tell you, which sort of makes the story I told you about the woman who couldn't walk kind of pale in comparison when I begin to tell you some of the stuff we've been doing. really what we're trying to invite people into is freedom.
Yeah.
And freedom basically means that you can be fully present and you can like be fully engaged in the here and now. Your heart is, you're fully open-hearted and compassionate. You're fully open-minded and curious. And when you're there, and when you know ultimately that who you are is everything and everything is who you are, how can anyone ever do anything to you? But of course, that's like a North Star. That's like, you know, Christ or something. Mm-hmm. And even he is an exemplar, you know, a little before he's dying, he's going, why hast thou forsaken me? He's anxious. Yeah. He's like comparing. He's like, you know, he's judging. And at the end, he's free. He says, basically, you know, they're just not aware. They're not aware that they can't kill me.
Yeah.
And in killing me, they're killing themselves. And we have to open our hearts. So we're, what we're selling is that kind of freedom for everybody. People don't come in for that, but that's what I think true integration is to bring together all those centers and in far more than the personal. So it's you as a person, but you as members of systems, ultimately to you being sort of a mystical cell in the mystical body of life itself. And as soon as you know that's who you are holographically, you'd say, who I am is everything. So I'm the person I'm traumatizing. I'm the person who's violating me. I'm all of those people. And I'm everything else. And that's true freedom, because then nothing can make you suffer.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by integration. But why most of us aren't there. So something happens and we can't handle it and we can't integrate it. And when that happens, we suffer because we're no longer free. And we start to move automatically. And it's like, instead of being able to respond in the current moment, we're reliving something else. We're reliving echoes of something else. And so we're not free. So what's therapy? Therapy is simple to describe. If people come to therapy for only one reason, really, if they're coming to therapy, if they're coming to coaching, it's slightly different. But if they're coming to therapy, ultimately, where they start in is one thing. I can't handle something. They don't know that. And then, so what's therapy? Therapy is mastering what can't be handled. And fascinatingly, the very things that you're suffering about will always be a clue to the thing that couldn't be remembered. So on a personal level, it's like it's a nightmare. But on a soul level, it's an invitation to remember something so you can be the one doing the remembering as opposed to being identified with the one who's being remembered. And all of our symptoms we suffer about on one level are simply clues to what it is that we're trying to remember so we can be free. And then it's easy to tell you how that happens, okay? You can tell, it's easy to say how it happens. It's not necessarily easy to do, but it's easy to say how it happens, which is who you are in the beginning is basically free-flowing energy. And when something happens that can't be handled and integrated, you go from being E, like energy, to M, like matter. You slow down and densify. And that's what happens to us. And so whenever there's something that can't be handled, that you can't say yes to, in that moment, a sensation is born. Just like Matthew's born in a moment, in the moment something can't be handled, the sensation is born. And so you could say, interestingly, every discomfort you have in your body is a narrative of some kind or a story that couldn't be handled, right? And every story that can't be handled has an exact equivalent sensation to it. So how do you heal trauma? It's very simple. You choose to experience the trauma as opposed to experiencing it automatically. And how you do that is also very simple to say, which is you bring all your attention, you focus all your attention so much on that sensation that you become it. And then we're no longer talking to Matthew, we're talking to tight throat.
Yeah.
And if Matthew says, I know what tight throat is, I'd say, Matthew, like, you know, if I'm talking to Fred over there and you tell me you know more about Fred than Fred knows, Fred might say, why are you telling me? So yeah. I never talk to Matthew. I talk to tight throat. And basically all we need to do is we need to find out what it really is, what the real intention is that's blocked, where it originated, and what it needs. If just sharing its story while you are the witness host isn't enough. So you need to do three things, okay? And if you can, and so what I've done basically is, If you just came in and I didn't do anything else and you said, I'm having a panic attack, I'd say, Matthew, when you're having your panic attack, what's happening in the body? You'd say, I'm breathing hard. I can't stop breathing. My chest is pounding. I'd say, okay, Matthew, all I want you to do is bring all your attention to chest pounding or migraine headache or whatever it is. You're going to choose to bring your attention there. And then you're no longer unconsciously and unaware migraine headache. You're someone who's holding or hosting or witnessing or remembering whoever or whatever that is, okay? So that's the simple basic premise. You come because there's something that can't be handled and integrated. That's why you come. All therapy is mastering it, and the way to master it is to choose to experience what you couldn't handle before. Mm-hmm. Now, I will tell you something fascinating, which is, in my experience, having done this for 27 years, if you have any witness function whatsoever and you choose to become the body sensation, you cannot become re-traumatized because we're not regressing you, right? Let's say something horrific happened to you at age 2, right? Most people would think that I'm regressing Matthew to age 2, but I'm not regressing Matthew to age 2. The 2-year-old Matthew is here right now, and so is the witness. So if Matthew chooses to experience that 2-year-old and chooses to bring his attention there, he will be choosing to identify with it while truly identifying with the one who is witnessing and holding and hosting and remembering. Mm-hmm. And so how could you possibly be re-traumatized? Yeah. But I think most therapists think, because some people are kinesthetic, some people are auditory, and some people are visual, someone might start to relive ritual abuse, but they wouldn't really be identified with it. They'd be the one identified with the one who chose to experience the ritual abuse, even if they're lying on my floor screaming. But most therapists don't like people lying on their floor screaming, so they think you have to resource them. But that's not been my experience in 27 years. I have not once seen that happen. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Then the only thing you need to know is what the real intention is. And I'll tell you what I mean. Panic attack. Let's suppose you're in my office, right? And motorcycle backfires and you suddenly have a panic attack.
Yeah.
Right? Well, clearly you're not having a panic attack probably because the motorcycle backfired. That's not likely. But there may be a direct connection. So let's suppose 10 years ago you were a soldier in a war and a bomb went off, right? And it's a loud noise. So now when you hear that motorcycle backfiring, you are now again in the war having the panic attack, right? So that's a fairly direct connection. And then I can work with you on your reaction to the loud sound because there's a one-to-one correspondence.
Yeah.
And we can easily find that war 10 years ago, right? But let me give you a different example. Let's suppose the same thing happens and motorcycle backfires, you have a panic attack. But let's suppose this time, in a way I can tell you about, however you want to believe this, it's 1918, and instead of being one of the soldiers, you're the leader of the soldiers, and you're not paying enough attention, and you walk them into an ambush where grenades and bombs are going off, and you watch them die, right? Now your problem is not the sound. Really, your problem is that in your lack of care, you betrayed a trust, right? So the sound just becomes a symptom. Your reaction to the sound is a clue to what's going on back there, but it's not the most elegant clue. If I could find out that your real issue is betrayal, right? And I drop you into I betrayed a trust, which I can find out, then when you go back there, you'll be focusing on the betrayal. And then what? Let's suppose you came in, and I'll give you a different example, because this guy, unbeknownst to me, he's also OCD, right? He's got obsessive compulsive disorder. And he has reactions to loud sounds, and he hates taking initiative, and anytime someone invites him to a leadership position, he shoots himself in the foot. And if he literally shoots himself in the foot, it's probably because shrapnel hit him, right? So if he really had pain in his foot at that point, it may be that not only does he figuratively shoot himself in the foot, he literally shot himself in the foot.
Yeah.
So let's suppose he has foot pain also, right?
Yeah.
So he has chronic pain that he doesn't understand, right? Foot pain. He's not aware of betraying, but what he is aware of is his reactions to loud sounds. He's OCD. Why? Because he wasn't paying enough attention, and he now has this belief that you would say is an irrational belief that if I'm not paying attention, people will die, right? Except it's not an irrational belief. It's a totally rational belief. All you have to know is who has the belief, because to them it's rational. Now, let's suppose I can find out his problem is betrayal, and it started in whatever you want to call World War I. Whether you think of that as another lifetime, or maybe he had an ancestor in World War I, so he's playing that out, or you can call it personal mythology. I don't care what you call it. But let's suppose we can get him back there to World War I and focus him on betrayal and transform that betrayal, which I could teach somebody how to do. It's not that hard to do. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of 20 minutes, if that's the only reason, his reactions to loud sounds might disappear. His OCD might disappear. His foot pain might disappear. His not taking initiative might disappear. And his sabotaging himself whenever he's becoming a leader might disappear. Now, if you told me in graduate school, because I've seen stuff like that is not out of the experience I've had.
Right.
If you told me in graduate school, I could take care of chronic pain that nobody knew what the heck it was, right? And I could take care of sabotaging yourself when you're a leader, and I could take care of OCD, and I could take care of lack of initiative, and I could take care of over-responsibility in 30 minutes, I would have said, pigs fly to the moon. Except now I have to think it's possible, because I've seen things like that happen on actually many occasions in my work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need to be able to find out if the thing you come in with is in fact your intention, the loud sounds, or if it's just a symptom that's a manifestation of a deeper intention, in this case, betrayal. And so what we've done is, as best we could, is we've mapped out all of the kinds of universal themes that have come up throughout history and in my client work, and we put them into categories. And then we can find out if your problem looks like loud sounds. I can ask through muscle testing, which we could talk about if you like, mm-hmm. Is that really your highest intention? Or is that really a symptom that is a manifestation of a deeper intention? And if it is, you know what it is. And if you don't, could I find it for you? Because we've sort of mapped out all of these themes. And anything you can imagine could be it. So it could be something like betrayal. It could be something like you're cursed. It could be anything. It could be anything that you've ever heard of could be what it is. And since most people don't think about other, and then you have to find where it originated. And some people work forever in this lifetime and they say, I haven't really got things done. In fact, I had a woman with ritual abuse who was like that. And she had been in therapy for about 15 years and she was still having a lot of symptoms. She thought it was good therapy. So I muscle tested. She said, these symptoms must be about my ritual abuse when I was young. It was horrendous what she went through. And I muscle tested. I said, did it originate there? And it said, no. And moreover, in the story, I found out that she had a horrific death. We call that a death wish. Mm-hmm. So I had her drop into a part of her that was experiencing that it had dissociated before it died. And she actually went to what you could call another lifetime that for her, given her belief systems, was actually far more horrendous than the ritual abuse. Mm-hmm. And she ended up dead. And when she transformed that death wish, the remaining symptoms all went away. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say you have to know where it originates. And then they may need a practice, like for those of us who know EFT, they may need, you know, tapping, they may need EMDR, they may need a spiritual practice, they may need to reassociate and then choose to die and go to source, and they may know what they need. And sometimes people come up with the most amazing stuff and their work transforms. So that is a brief overview of how I work with trauma. And now I've talked forever, so I'll be quiet.
Well, the challenge you give me, my friend, is where to go next with all that great stuff. But one thing I'd just like to say, I appreciate, you know, what you said, because one of the things that I do on occasion when I go and talk at conferences, and actually my good friend, Dr. Deborah Bourne from San Francisco, just an amazing medical doctor. We partner whenever we were going to end up on spiritual health. Because one of the things that I find interesting, you meet some new colleagues, you go out for dinner, and you've got all these clinical minds, these researchers. And after a glass of wine, we're talking about their shamanic experiences, their chakras, their past lives. So, you know, there's this level of spiritualness in a lot of us, not all of us, but I love it when my friend and I get to do these trainings, there are people sitting on our feet because the room is so packed, because we don't kind of in the mainstream provide space to talk about this. professionally. So I want to unpack, maybe get a little specific on something you said, because it's very interesting to me. Your use of energy, and the word energy, you know, big fan of Daniel Siegel's kind of definition of the mind is the flow of energy and information. But I wonder, in your model of thinking about human psychology, human spirituality, when you say energy, what do you mean and how do you work with that or redirect it? I'd love to get your thoughts a little deeper on the subject of energy and how you see that.
All right. Well, there's a technical definition of energy, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the capacity and the willingness and the capacity actually to be able to act, right? Yeah. That's what it is. But that's not how I want to talk about with you, since you asked me. I want to talk about it in terms of chi or ki or prana, mm-hmm. or shakti. I want to talk about it in terms of life force. So I think our energy is what you might call an animating force that is the same for everything in the whole universe. It has all the same energy, just vibrating at different levels, okay? Yeah. And I think that's what chi is. And so I think chi is when you could say in a subjective sense, it's when you're totally in the flow, right? Mm-hmm. And nothing is blocking you. And that literally is who you are, is that flow, is that energy that just flows. And it really is your life force. And I think in this dimension, it really is. I think we have to talk about infinite energy also, an infinite mind. But in this dimension, it really is, the best you could talk about it would be energy as Einstein talked about it, which is the speed of light squared. And I think actually the metaphysics and the physics are the same. So let's suppose we want to talk about chi in this dimension, right? Well, it's your animating force, but it's also your deepest intuitive knowing, right? And what do I mean by that? It's when you just know something is true. You don't figure it out, which is not animating. It's not like you even have an emotion about it. You have a felt sense. And the other way it shows up, this animating force, there's so many directions to go with this. It's kind of funny. I'll tell you the way you really know about it and how it's useful to us, right? How it's useful to us is that, you know, suppose you're a father, right, in your case, and suddenly a car rolls over your young toddler, and you have to pick up that car, and it's 2,000 pounds, or make it more, you're a 120-pound mother, right? And you hear these stories of these mothers who pick up the cars, and they're on YouTube and on whatever. My colleague said, you got to check this out, because I tell this story, you're crazy. But she does. She keeps me not saying things I shouldn't say. And so really what it says is that when you're in alignment with life, right? You ask that person, how could they do it? They just said, I just knew I could do it. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not about willpower. It's not about adrenaline. It's just a kind of force that says, I'm aligned with life. And when I'm aligned with life, I can pick up a 2,000 pound car, which is an amazing thing. When you're not aligned with life, you hurt your back. But when you are, you pick up the car, right? So I think that level of energy is a third level of wisdom, actually, that's called chi. And that's when we can really begin to talk about energy that's in free flow. Because the things we can figure out, you know, if I say to you, Matthew, what's your name? You say, I can figure that out, I'm Matthew. If I say, how much is 2 + 2? You say, I can figure that out, it's 4. If I say, Matthew, how come you're having anxiety attacks and what should you do about it? You'd say, well, I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be seeing you.
Exactly.
Right? But then what you need to know also is that in the service of healing and growth, I think there's infinite energy, and I'll tell you what I mean. And I think it explains, if you're interested in sort of quantum mechanics and relativity and why there was no unified theory, I think there was no unified theory because neither one of them in a funny kind of way gets to infinite energy. And, or at least that's my understanding of them. I will tell you, I'm not a physicist and I took one physics course in my life called Space, Time, and Motion. So for you physicists out there, forgive me if I'm wrong. But what I'd say is, I think the model, the holographic model that says it's really like cells and bodies, right? So it's like, on the one hand, you could say we have 3 trillion cells in our body, right? And theoretically, you could look at any of them or all of them, you'd never find 2 that were alike. But underneath it, they have to be alike, because theoretically, if you had enough information, you could take 1 cell over here and spontaneously clone the whole body. And that's who I think we are in the universe. So if you want to say who we are is infinite energy, I think what we are is infinite holograms that have been broken up into gajillions of pieces. And on the surface, we're all different. But underneath it, we're all the same. And the only question is, how much do you identify with the surface, with Matthew, or your personality, or your body, or whatever it is? Because as soon as you do that, you've taken that infinite energy and densified it. But the second you realize you're the template, you are the blueprint, then you have this funny experience of, I'm in relationship with life. Everyone is in relationship with life. I am life, and I am everyone. And that's how it is that information can spontaneously move, and it can explain things that relatively can't exactly explain, like how can things move faster than the speed of light? And the answer is, it's not moving. It's all happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's why we can get information. Like, I could ask you a question, like I could muscle test a question, and I could ask it in Swahili, and you'd say, I don't know Swahili. Or I could say, is your highest intention, that you were abducted by extraterrestrials? And you say, I don't believe in that. But some part of you would say, if it's possible, maybe it's true. And even if you've never heard of it, it's available to you. So we can ask anything in this. If you bring it back to healing, in the service of healing and evolving, which is chi, you can ask anything you like, because you're not ego attached. And that's why I think I can ask questions. Like, someone comes in and they say, I'm sure it was this, right? And I'll say, well, if you're sure it is, put out your arm. And I'll just stand aside and I'll say, was it that? No. I'll say, well, some deeper part of you is saying that's not it. But the answers are at least coming through you, yeah. You know? So it's if you're listening to this, you can't see. If you don't know muscle testing, it's just a way of accessing deepest wisdom. And if I have someone live, I have them just hold out their arm and I just ask yes, no questions about what their real intention is, where it originated, and what that person needs. Or that being, right? But now I can't do that. And I work with people all over the place. So all I do is I ask to stand in for them, because I can focus on them in the template, because I'm everything. So if I'm doing a session with Matthew in Denver, I just say, okay, I'm going to focus on Matthew, and you can't see this. But if I then said, I just move forward, my body just moves on its own, and I say, my name is Matthew, will say yes, and my name is Andy, will say no. And then I can surrogately muscle test Matthew, because in that moment I am, which is a pretty crazy thought for a guy who sort of is a Jewish intellectual from Boston, but you know, what can I say?
Hey, your Jewish tradition has a lot of spirituality to it.
It certainly does, and I love the Kabbalah, and yeah. My brother is a true expert on it, and I think all of this stuff is there. I mean, when I heard the Kabbalah say, what is gravity? Gravity is love.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, it goes pretty deep, yeah.
Well, because all of these things are physical, but they're metaphysical. You say, well, what's an energy, right? That 2 things are pulled towards each other. What do we call that? We call it love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an amazing thing. And I actually think everything is about that. You know, it's like if we could be with anything and say, I may not like you yet, but if I can be aware of you and allow you and accept you and bring my attention to you, it's kind of like I love you.
Mm.
Yeah. And if we could bring to our worst fears, right? The things we're most afraid to admit about ourselves, we'd say, I'd rather be dead than have to admit that, right? Well, what do those fears say? They say, like, really? You think you can get away from me? I'm bigger than you are. And I've always been here. For me, it's like feeling like I'm ordinary, right? It's like, oh, God, I have to prove I'm not. Right? And then there's something wrong with me because I'm ordinary. If you know, I don't know if you know the Enneagram, but if you do you know the Enneagram?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a romantic. I'm romantic in the Enneagram. So, you know, I have to be special because I can't be ordinary. But, ordinary says, you think you can get away from me? Ha! And I say, you know,
Yeah.
I'm bigger than you, and I've been here, I'll always be here, and you can curse me, you can deny me, you can do whatever, and guess what? You can't get away from me. I promise you I'll stay with you. Mm-hmm. Well, what is that in a different tone? It's the divine.
Yeah.
I'm bigger than you are, you know? So the interesting thing is, the things that we're most afraid to face, when they say, you know, where's the keys to the kingdom? They're inside. It's the things that are everything that for us are non-existence, right? Because if we become everything, we cease to exist. So we say, I'm not going to become who I truly am, because that's non-existence, or smaller black holes calls I'm defective, or I'm a nobody or whatever. But really, it's just misnaming of the divine. It's misnaming of a black hole that is the fullness of the emptiness. So that's why I say, if you can be with anything, you're free. Then you can tell me, Andy, you know what, there's a better person down the block. And I'd say, well, okay, I'll go check them out. Right? Anyway.
Yeah, well, I would love to explore the holographic model of the universe, because it's something I won't put my listeners through my own intellectual, never liked dark matter energy all that much. So I like this new model that's sort of coming out. But, you know, the question that comes to mind, and, you know, I love how just kind of things work out, because right now I have my Qigong book right on top of my HRV book. And let me let that...
Both sides covered.
That coherence, so to speak, of book layouts. One of the things I've been really fascinated with, and your muscle testing kind of speaks to this in a way I was never trained to get this, but... You know, as I learned, and you know, as somebody who's been fascinated both through my personal experiences with it, but also kind of seeing how, boy, let's not forget the thousands, who knows how many tens of thousands of years of wisdom. We usually know when they get written down, we can start dating them, but there's wisdom to back that up, like Tai Chi, like yoga. You know, one of the things that I'd sort of been frustrated with as a trauma clinician is, you know, understanding the impact of trauma on how brains function and operate, and the energy inherent to that system. And right now, I'm very fascinated with the vagal, the polyvagal system. And, you know, I look at what's in my, you know, Chinese medicine books with the meridians, and it might not be a one-to-one matchup with the vagus nerve, but boy, it's really close. You know, and so, like, my interest in heart rate variability is you can kind of get inside the skin to take a measure of the health of the autonomic nervous system, which is, you know, as Hermes said, as below, so above. We see so much reflection as without, so within. Like, you know, bringing this kind of historical tradition. So I would love to just get your thoughts on, as we talk about energy, there's this biological revolution going on. As I say, we live in many ways a golden age of psychology, because we understand at least the biology behind the psychology in a way, you know, just a different way, at least in Western terms, than we did when I was trained back in the late 90s. So I'm kind of wondering, as you see this explosion of research in, you know, the vagus nerve, heart rate variability, sinus arrhythmia, neurobiology, how do you integrate this thinking? It seems like it'd be really easy to do, but I'd love to just get your thoughts on the coalition between science and some of the traditional wisdom traditions you've been talking about.
What I would say is energy creates matter. Mm-hmm. All right. So I would say your biology is a manifestation of a field. Mm-hmm. So I don't think biology is where things start. It's where we can witness something more easily right now. Although if you think about things like infinite mind, we can test fields very easily also. So what I would say is, I would say that when there is the kinds of things you're talking about with the vagus nerve and what happens in the brain, I would say that that's a manifestation of an energetic where there has been something that couldn't be handled and integrated. Mm-hmm. And so, because we've been doing our own, we're starting to do our own biological research. And I guess what I'd say is when you move into witness function and then you find a trauma, you'll find that the brain function shifts.
Yeah.
And the heart rate shifts and everything shifts. And so I think I would not say that. I would say it's one manifestation of something that is a higher order. Mm-hmm. And so I'm fascinated by it, but I have to say, I guess I have to say that I'm more interested in what the results are if you know that everything is a manifestation of energy and whether it's become dense or not. And of course, if the energy becomes dense, it's going to affect the field, because what is our body? It's just a dense energy we've identified with. Mm-hmm. So I think mind creates brain, right? And I think soul creates heart. And I would say spirit creates body. And so I get very interested to see how it manifests in the brain or in the heart or in the body. But I think it's, I don't know how to put this differently, because I think if you start in a different place, then you don't have to worry about what the vagus nerve can't do. But that's my experience for 27 years. I don't think there's a limit around these things. I think if you can transform the thing that couldn't be handled, your brain function follows.
Yeah.
If you can transform what couldn't be handled, the heart rate variability comes into alignment.
Yeah.
I think if you transform what couldn't be handled, you're no longer a victim, feeling like you're a victim of fate when you have chronic pain. Mm-hmm. So I'm not exactly answering your question. I guess I can say I know the research quite well, and it's just, I find it for me not where my attention goes as much.
Yeah.
But I have great respect for it, and I have great respect for Stephen Porges, and I have great respect for Bessel, and I love heart math, and I love all these things. It's just, I'm starting from a slightly different premise that's more sort of, I guess I would say ultimately Eastern and in the, you know, the mysteries and how those manifest in matter.
Yeah.
I don't know if that speaks to your question or not. But
yeah, I mean, I just find it fascinating that we're able, like you said, I mean, I think that, you know, whether it's the field of epigenetics, neurobiology, this sort of revolution of knowledge that we're getting, you know, I just find, you know, it's fascinating when we can measure the impact of, you know, improvement of psychological, spiritual wellness, whatever you kind of want to label is. You know, there is ways to start to measure this. And, you know, I think as we enter this like realm of best practice and evidence-based models and all this stuff, which, you know, is important and sometimes I think overblown, you know, I think it's interesting that we're starting to get to a technological point of view where I'm not ready to say heart rate variability measures chi. I think you've got to write, you've got to really put that together. I think I could make a decent argument for it, but it'd be a layman's argument because I'm not an expert on chi and all the meridians. I'm a novice who's interested with it. But you know, so that's to me what's fascinating. But one of the things that you also said that I'd be interested in from your perspective in is that the mind creates, you know, the brain. And one of the things that I've really, I wouldn't say struggle with because I love to be wrong, because if I'm wrong, I get to learn something new. And every time that I can change my paradigm, to me, that's wisdom. It's like, I got to break stuff down. I got to build it back up. One of the things I just love, and I know we're kind of running low on time, so you can run with this as far or short as you want to. You know, one of the things that I've learned, I think about trauma is that there is that biological injury in some way. You know, we see, you know, from a very generic point of view, prefrontal cortex with chronic complex compound trauma is less active in brain scans, can be physically smaller in size, amygdala larger in size. We see more activation of sympathetic dorsal, less activation of ventral vagal. So I'd love to get your mixes. You know, I think as adults, one of the things I'm very fascinated in, and I've kind of got to fall back, and for those who've heard me talk on this, to quantum physics and looking at ions firing to talk about the human mind and how we sort of, in some ways, our biology responds as children, I think, a lot of times to the trauma inflicted on us. And then as therapists, we try to help people find power to regain control, to have that integration, which I would agree with you. I would also call that the mind, but I just kind of would love to get your thoughts of how do you help people who may have been, you know, like you said, victims of ritual abuse, that something happened to them. And as children, may have not had a whole lot of chance to have a lot of power in that situation, start to regain control after a history of trauma, and how that your concept of the mind plays into that healing process.
I think the way you regain control is two things happen when there's a trauma. There's the trauma and its effects, and there's the way we try to protect ourselves. The way to regain control, I would say, is about acceptance. If you can become aware, allow, bring your attention to and accept something, now you're free. It doesn't run your life, all right? The way you do that, I think, is to choose to face it. And I'll give you an example of what I mean, because you're talking about terrible things. I saw a woman, this was a long time ago, and she came in and she was clearly what we call DID. She had times she couldn't account for, and she was psychotic. She had bugs crawling all over her. And so I was doing my muscle testing with her, and she had a horrendous history. I mean, like, it included rape, incest, watching murders. I mean, really horrendous. Any one of which could have done this thing, right? So I do my muscle testing with her, and it says, none of those are the root cause of what is her syndrome. It says, this is a weird story, but I can tell you several stories like this. And I find out it's what we call a superimposition. And I say to her, does this make any sense to you that when, because I found out it happened when she was from 6 to 10 years old. I said, does that make any sense to you that some kind of energy took you over when that happened, and somehow or other that's got to do with how you feel broken apart? And she looked at me like I had five heads, and she said, I'm going to tell you something. When I was 8 years old, I was she was Southern Baptist, and she was in a fire and brimstone sermon her father was giving. And I won't go much more into detail except to say I've already said some of the things that happened to her. And she said, during that service, a dark energy came in and took me over, and I've never been the same since. And I felt totally weird after that. Like, I could have handled the other things, but I couldn't handle this. She was actually a good reporter when she wasn't having bugs crawling all over her and, like, was a different personality. But and she was a good reporter here. And she said, she was already seeing a psychiatrist because of all the things that nobody was talking about. And she told him what happened. And he said to her, you're crazy. And he put her on Thorazine. She was a very good reporter. I trusted this when she was 8 years old, at which point she vowed never to tell anybody. And 30 years later, I say, because in our system is these non-material phenomena, and I say, does that make sense to you? And she says, I know exactly what you're talking about. And she says, I know when it happened too. And I said, all right, what we're going to do is we're going to choose, because you're in witness function right now, to go back to that scene, and you're going to become you again, not that energy, but the you that it's happening to. And you're going to talk about what's happening. And she does. And the room gets literally dark. Okay. But it says she knows what to do to heal this. And so she says to me in this very strange voice, she said, I have to do a dance. This woman is 1/16th Native American. I won't say what tribe. Well, this is long ago. It'd be hard to find her. And she lets me use her name, but I'm not going to here anyway. She starts to do this dance. And she's doing this sacred dance that, like, is looking like she's creating, like a, if you know, the flower of life, it kind of looks like that, but it's clearly Native American. And about a minute into it, she looks up at me like, what am I doing? Because she doesn't know it. She's being danced, right? Yeah. And about a minute after that, you kind of can feel the room energetically shake. Literally, even somebody, and you can feel the room get lighter, and she says she's done. All right, that woman was hospitalized 1 to 2 times per year prior to that session. You know how many times she was hospitalized after that? Zero, the whole time I saw her. And then I stopped seeing her because I moved away. But I saw her 25 years later by accident. And she said, she remembered the session. She said it changed her whole life. Wow. So I would say that all of these things, you know, they're just, I think things happen to us. Mm-hmm. And then we're not free.
Yeah.
That's what I would say. I want to get back to what's fundamental.
Yeah.
And it can be strange things like dark energies taking you over, your father yelling at you, or something that happened to your great-great-grandfather on your mother's side, or something that happens in the future even, because it might send you back a warning. But if you can find what it is that couldn't be handled and integrated and just say, I'll be with you and I'll give you what you need, the world changes. If you're doing yoga and you run into a posture and you hit a limitation, but you know it's not, you know, your physical limitation, and you say, okay, pain in leg, what are you coming to share with me? Watch what happens to brain function. Mm-hmm. Watch what happens to heart function.
Yeah.
And we're testing it, and I can tell you, I mean, you know, we're a little organization, you know, I would love to go into more, but it's like, it is what it is. So what I'm interested in is the person, all of their bandings, from the most individual to the collective, and that is mind. We are the body. There is no such a thing as an effect on the body. We are a mind, heart, body field. There is no, you can't say the mind and body are connected, because they're the same. Whatever happens to the body happens to the mind. Whatever happens to the mind happens to the body. Whatever happens to both of them happens to the heart. There is no distinction. There's nothing. That's who we are. And then we can see it in amazing ways in our Western technology. We can see the effects of what happens when we begin to get to a place of greater mindfulness in a somatic kind of way, which is all I'm saying you do. If you can take your mind, if you can say, I know what's here, I can tune into a deeper part of me that just knows something, and I can tune in when I feel anxious or judging or comparative or whatever it is I'm feeling, and find the sensation and say, I'm here with you, everything changes. And it happens in a moment. And the reason it happens in a moment is the thing that can't be handled happens in a moment. So why can't the change happen literally in a moment? And it doesn't matter whether I'm talking, if you have any witness function at all, I don't care if you call it ritual abuse or your father yelled at you because you were writing poetry and then you could never be a writer again. It's just quantitative differences.
Yeah.
It's not qualitative differences. And everything the person says is they're sharing their story of the part that couldn't be.